seize the day with their song Food and Health and Hope about the Monsanto Corporation, a poster child for the moral transgressions of scientists and capital, a company that's a leader in creating dangerous, unneeded products and engaging in political corruption. Scientists have all too often aligned themselves with such reactionary forces in the name of progress that socially conscious people in the scientific community have had to form groups like the Union of Concerned Scientists and Science for the People. Our next speaker, biologist Paul Ehrlich, took up the question of the social responsibilities of scientists when he spoke at a recent conference of Australian ecologists in Perth. Another issue that he, as well as our final speaker, will touch upon is one that has also been a religious battleground, the question of human population and the Earth's ability to support it, especially in the lifestyle of the modern industrial society. Thanks to Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock for making this recording from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation available. Ehrlich is introduced by Robin Williams.
Here is an internationally renowned biologist and environmental stirrer at the Perth Convention Centre, strolling on stage with his hands in his pockets or gesticulating for effect, and just chatting. No notes in sight. Just that Paul Robeson rich baritone and a few incendiary remarks, not least about what he calls the crime family bush. Paul Ehrlich was once world famous. His book, The Population Bomb, in 1968, came shortly after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring from 1962. Professor Ehrlich's scenarios, as he called them, were taken as predictions by his critics and condemned as such. Whether you see the world as now in crisis or in transition is a matter of judgment. But there's no doubt that this professor from Stanford University in California and member of the American Academy is, shall we say, stimulating. Here on stage in Perth at the Ecological Society of Australia conference is Professor Paul Ehrlich.
There are two things that worry me greatly about climate change. One is, and hopefully many of you will agree with this, it's not at all clear that climate change is the worst, horrible as it is the worst environmental threat facing us. The second is that hopefully you all know the IPCC is hopelessly conservative on issues of climate change. It has to be. It has to get agreement from governments and industry before it can say anything. There are huge battles, if you know anything about it, that go on about this. I don't know a single climatologist who doesn't think that the most recent report is absurdly conservative. There may be some, there obviously are some who don't agree with that, but I think if you do a mental meta-analysis, look around the world and see what's going on, you can see, or read the literature if you're able to read, and see what's going on. Ann and I were in Brazil about 2 months ago. The Pantanal was in a record drought and burning. The Cerrado was in a record drought and burning. California is in a record drought and burning. I've heard the rumor that there are sections of Australia that are not doing too great, although Graham Pike, an ecologist, some of you know, and I went out looking for the painted honey eater around Royalston in New South Wales Thursday and Friday, and we brought a 5-year record rain, so the New South Wales people have some debt to us. I was in Greece for a conference of European environmental economists about half a year ago. Greece was burning at the time. If you're a resident of Atlanta, Georgia, you discover that it's not all that likely there will be water coming out of your taps unless the climate changes again pretty soon, because they're in a record drought. The most recent work by a whole bunch of people on grain yields, many of you probably saw it, indicates that the small amount of warming that has already occurred has reduced what the yields are today over what they would have been just based on technological change. In other words, the yields haven't been going down, but they haven't been going up as fast as they might have because of the problems of crop varieties having thermal limits on them, particularly the world's feeding base, which, of course, are those three famous grains. They say that rice is within 2 or 3 degrees of its limit over most of Asia. Now, of course, somebody is sure to get up and say, bah, we have the doomsday vault. in the Arctic, where we're going to save seeds from all these crops so we'll be able to breed new strains that will be able to do just great when the planet is 6 or 7 degrees Celsius hotter. Well, what, of course, what do you do in a seed bank? Same damn thing you do in a zoo. You select organisms for storage attributes, not for their ability to reproduce under higher climate things and so on and so forth. Only way to save the genetic diversity of crops is to keep planting them out in diverse circumstances and diverse strains and subsidize farmers to grow less productive ones so you have the diversity saved. They're not doing that. They're not even thinking about that over most of the world. So where most people in, well, first of all, in the United States, under the Bush crime family, the education system has deteriorated and science has lost all of its battles. So people, I mean, talk about climate change there, they think you're talking about the ozone layer. In other words, that's the level of sophistication. But otherwise, what they're mostly scared of is sea level rise. And I try to explain to people, you'll probably be able to outrun it. You never hear, the talk about little problems like the salinization of coastal aquifers. But the other terrible thing, and I say this to you when you're hopefully all talking to your politicians about this, this isn't going to be a redealing of the cards with winners and losers. It's going to be centuries of continual change. Continual change, for example, in precipitation patterns. So that means you have to figure, and this is something, by the way, ecologists and economists are doing a lot together now on these issues. Think of the costs of changing continually the world's water handling infrastructure as the demand continually grows and as the climate continually changes. Now, I recently saw somebody saying, don't worry about the heating in the center of the United States. They'll simply keep growing corn further north. No thought about the transaction costs of doing that. No thought of the problems of growing corn in Hudson Bay, which the soil's very, very thin in Hudson Bay, or on the Canadian Shield, and so on and so forth. In other words, most of the cures that are discussed for climate change aren't really cures, and there's a bunch of them out there which are simply crackpot biogeochemicals experiments on gigantic scales. You know, you dump 60 squadrillion tons of iron filings into Sydney Harbor, and if the climate doesn't change in the right direction, you get your graduate students out there with tweezers pulling them back out, right? Or you put a sun shield. There's one plan you may have seen for putting a sun shield between us and the sun, which is not likely to have much effect on the acidification of the oceans, on and on and on. In other words, yes, the attention of the public is turned to climate change. It's turned to climate change to the degree that our absolutely incompetent press is now totally focused upon it, not looking at any of the other incredibly serious issues that face us in any kind of a sophisticated way, and not looking at climate change in a sophisticated way. Most of the stuff you read in the general press, at least in the United States, is pure crap. So we have a problem there. We have very rapid change. The scientific community pretty much knows what's going on, but doesn't know how to get the message through, and I'm not saying I do, to the press and the general public or the politicians. And I'll come back to the politicians later if I have time. What happened to that bottle of gin you promised me? Oh, my God. The ice is all melted. One has to keep one's spirit up when discussing these things. What are some of the other problems? Oh, by the way, I just to give you an indicator, in 2004, we organized a big press conference of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., trying to bring environmental issues at least back into the edge of the presidential campaign. The thing that struck me more than anything else was out of maybe 45, 50 questions on the environment, there was not one that wasn't on climate change. In other words, none of the other environmental issues appeared at all. What are some of the other issues that we're all concerned with? Many of them, of course, connected with climate change. Many ecologists think land use change is likely to be a bigger threat and do more damage. It, of course, is also tied in with climate change, not only affecting the climate, being affected by the climate. Fragmentation is everywhere. The invasive species are moving essentially everywhere. The nitrogen cycle is being overloaded, essentially, everywhere, and biodiversity is under threat everywhere. It was, again, I'll be really controversial. We saw in a very nice talk by the science minister a couple of minutes ago, one of the results of what I like to call Darwin's mistake. What was Darwin's mistake? I am possibly the world's greatest fan of Darwin. But he didn't do absolutely everything right. And one of his biggest mistakes was to name his classic book, which I have now read three times, On the Origin of Species. It should have been On the Differentiation of Populations. By putting the emphasis on species, first of all, he supplied employment for a lot of otherwise unemployable people who work as taxonomists and argue forever over what is a species. This would be the equivalent of people in geology saying, if you want to understand orogeny, you have to be able to define a mountain. And so the issue is, what is really a mountain? And you can think about that for a while. But worse than that, it's pushed all of our attention, the public's attention particularly, and we had an example here, on conservation of biodiversity, onto conserving species. You don't want the species to go extinct. Well, do a little thought experiment. Let's imagine somehow miraculously we could preserve every species on the planet by waving a magic wand as a single viable population forever. There would be no further loss of species diversity, and of course we'd all soon be dead, because we can't get along on just one viable population of each species, like rice, wheat, and so on, but all the other things. You can think about it. You can see that it's preposterous. What we have to have is a vast diversity of populations everywhere to supply the ecosystem services upon which our society absolutely depends. And yet, when did you last hear anybody standing up, besides me and a very few other colleagues maybe, getting up and say, we've got to preserve populations? You know, in the United States today, we're in trouble for pollinators. It's not because Apis mellifera no longer exists on the planet. It's just there are so many fewer of them than there used to be. And most of the native pollinators that could have substituted for them are now extinct because of habitat loss. So we have this incredible problem of the loss of biological diversity, particularly at the population level, much more serious than loss of diversity at the species level, that basically goes ignored. And we're beginning, you know, there's something like $18 billion worth of plants grown in the United States that require insect pollination, and we've now got colony collapse disorder. We'll probably get through it one way or another, but everything is going in the same direction, namely downhill. So land use change, huge factor. I remember, by the way, I was at a CSIRO conference here maybe a decade ago with the Taman Land Care Group here in Western Australia. And they were a fantastic group of people. They were doing something that was supremely intelligent. They were working very hard. How many of you know the Taman Land Care Group? I'm just curious. A wonderful lady ran it. I can't remember her name. Jocelyn something, I think. Anyway, what they were doing was planting native shrubs around the wheat fields that were getting salinated, pumping down the water table. Then the rains would wash the salt out. They could go back into wheat production. They also began to get birds back around the fields. And they had, I'm making up the numbers, but they did something like planted in the last year 400,000 shrubs in the year that I was out there. And of course, in the day I was out there, Queensland took down 418 million shrubs clearing land. So it's one of the things you want to watch out when you're talking about change is don't focus on the little success stories which show you what could be done, but always measure them against what the results are. What's the overall result? Australia has hammered its continent in incredible ways, and yet I wager you could probably find in Perth some idiot who thinks that you could use 90 million more Australians who will, you know, maybe they'll be successful. You know, in Victoria, they have a group of very fine scientists working very hard trying to figure out how to turn wine into water. And if they have success there, of course, maybe you could increase the population a fair amount. So land use change is a big issue. Go beyond that. What about toxification of the planet? One of Hal Mooney's favorite topics. We release thousands and thousands of toxic chemicals into the environment all the time. They are now, as you know, spread from pole to pole. Some of the really clever things we're doing, for instance, the hard plastic sports bottles, those hard plastics that are used in lots of things like baby bottles, they all leak alpha bisphenol, I believe it is, into their contents. Now, alpha bisphenol was originally synthesized as a hope for being an estrogen replacement. It wasn't quite powerful enough for that, so now babies all over the world are being fed an estrogen replacement in fairly sizable quantities, and the world is getting loaded with this stuff. It's never been tested for safety in human beings. Almost none of the chemicals we are releasing have been tested for safety in ecological systems, for what they do in ecological systems, but there's tens of thousands of them out there. They haven't been tested singly They certainly haven't been tested in two-way synergisms or three-way synergisms or on up to, 10,000-way synergisms. And yet we just release them. And many of them, I don't think, are used in ways that you would feel are really essential to humanity. We have a huge problem, economic and potentially biological, in dealing with the level of chemical pollution. And there are sad signs. As you well know, polar bears' testicles are dropping off. In many subarctic communities now, there are only half as many boys born as girls. Those are not cheering signs for the kind of crap that we're releasing into the environment. Worse yet, there aren't even any crackpot schemes for fixing it if it turns out, for example, that the human sperm count is going to drop to zero or something. You can always put up your space shields and possibly ruin the entire world, but at least there are crackpot schemes for dealing with global warming, global heating, as we prefer to call it now. There aren't even any crackpot schemes to deal for the change of turning the entire planet into a sea of biologically novel compounds about which we know, in most cases, essentially nothing. So that's another area of serious concern that isn't getting much concern these days. Another area which you're probably very familiar with here, but still is not talked about much in the United States, is the decay of the epidemiological environment. As you add more people to the planet, of course, what are you doing? Well, first of all, you're forcing more and more people in larger groups into closer contact with the animal reservoirs of infectious diseases. All of our infectious diseases came from other animals. The most recent one, of course, that's been popular is AIDS. And the chances of a transfer going on depend very heavily on not just the closeness of the contact, but how big the human group that may, where the transfer is made is. A, what are the probabilities of transfer? There's a better probability of transfer if you have 1,000 people in the area than if you have 10. After it's in there, what are the chances of it becoming established? Again, much higher if you have 1,000 people than if you have 10. You may remember actually work that Bob May, in part, did years ago, showing that you had to have a city of somewhere between 50 and 50,000 people before measles could take hold and persist. Otherwise, people became either dead or immune so fast that the disease died out. So we're building ourselves an ideal system for more transfers of novel viruses, in particular, into the human population. In China, more and more people are fooling around in ponds with more and more pigs and more ducks. It's kind of like a huge laboratory to develop nasty flu strains. The last flu epidemic was in a much smaller population. Many fewer people were immune compromised. There's no reason at all why we couldn't have a novel flu that killed 1 billion or more people, which would not help the economy a great deal. Very little attention being paid to this. In the United States, they haven't even started thinking about things like going back to isolation of people who get various diseases. So the epidemiological environment is in bad shape, and people like George Bush for a while were even defunding the Centers for Disease Control, which were sort of our first line of defense in the United States against such things. Then, of course, there's the issue that we were all involved in 20-some years ago, and that is the issue of the ecological effects of nuclear war. Now, many people think this is no longer a problem because, after all, the confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union is over. Well, first of all, most Americans and probably most of you don't realize that there are still thousands of nuclear warheads on both sides on missiles targeted at each other. That, in fact, in 1996, the world came within 8 minutes of total destruction because the Norwegians announced to the Russians that they were going to launch basically a scientific rocket experiment, a single rocket. By that time, the Russians' command and control system had deteriorated entirely, as had the brains of most of the people working on it through vodka, and the word didn't get through. And so they see this rocket go up, and it was interpreted as an attack from the United States. And they got 8 minutes into their 15-minute countdown before launching everything they had at us, and you wouldn't be here today if somebody hadn't figured out that it wasn't actually an attack. And you say, well, what the hell? We should reduce that number of missiles. Would somebody like to guess, for example, how many Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs it would take to destroy? That's a firecracker, about 15 kilotons. Most of them are megaton range now. Would take to destroy the United States as a functioning society? We did this back of the envelope calculation during the nuclear winter studies. It'd take about 11 or 12. All you got to do is hit the transport centers and most everybody starves to death. It turned out Russia required fewer, and of course five does Australia forever. And we have thousands of these things. And in fact, few people in the United States realize it. You know that the American Historical Society, 85% of the people voted to declare the Bush administration the worst administration in the history of the United States. That's interesting because the historians don't know a thing about the nuclear force posture. They don't know anything about climate change. They don't know anything about any of the things we've been talking about here. And they still thought Bush was the worst ever. I mean, Howard was a real, real amateur. I mean, a megamoron, yes. But just remember, if George Bush had stopped short sometime, Howard would have disappeared totally. So you guys were basically lucky. Anyway, to soldier on. We have a series of interacting problems that are not exactly great. And what is done about the drivers of them? People don't think about the drivers. Slowly but surely, I was very interested to see that the minister mentioned population growth. You could read American newspapers and watch TV channels forever and not know that we'd be in much better shape for energy and there'd be many fewer greenhouse gases in the atmosphere if U.S. had only 140 million people instead of 300 million. We celebrated vastly as a nation going through 300 million people in spite of the fact that no one has ever come up with an even semi-sane reason why there should be more than 140 million people alive in the United States at one time. You never hear any discussion, or virtually never in the United States, of the population problem. It's slowly starting to come back. But even then, they say, well, we're just going to add 3.5 billion more people to the planet by the end of the century. What don't they mention there? Well, they might mention, for instance, that when I was born, there were only 2 billion people on the whole planet. So 2.5 billion is a lot more than there was when I was born, when we seem to have enough people around to do things. But more important, they don't mention that that 2.5 billion may very well put more pressure on the ecological systems of the planet than the 3 or 4 billion that came before them. Why? Of course, every person you add disproportionately adds, on average, to the environmental impact. You can't get oil anymore by putting a pointy stick in the ground in Pennsylvania. You got to drill down a couple miles. Water has to be transported further. Ores, copper isn't lying around 100% on the surface anymore. You got to mine it at 1% or less. So everything means that you have to move things further. You have to win your metals from scarcer ores. You have to drill deeper for everything. And so the disproportionate impact of those 2.5 billion people is going to be ginormous. And one of the things, of course, the United States, we have no population policy. We are a truly underdeveloped country. We're not as underdeveloped as Australia in the sense that Australia is still, in the 40-some years I've been coming here, striving to become a third-world country, to be a place that just exports its natural capital as fast as possible, unworked upon, until it eventually becomes truly poverty-stricken. That's the Australian program. U.S. isn't quite so bad, but on population, we're worse, because we consume even more than you do per person, and we keep building up. We're the most overpopulated nation in the world, even though we're the third most populous. So you don't hear anything much about one of the drivers in the iPad equation, that's population. You certainly don't hear anything about a consumption except when the economy starts to wiggle a little bit, the politicians all stand up and go out, buy another car, buy a refrigerator, consume, consume, consume. Nobody's invented a consumption condom yet. One of my colleagues suggested that there be a consumption morning after pill, and that is a corporation that specializes in, after you've been out on a shopping spree, it goes out the next morning and grabs all your stuff and takes it back to the stores. The only cheery thing I can tell you on the consumption front is that the ecologists have been working well together now for more than a decade, and slowly but surely, the economists are starting to look at the issue of how and what consumption do you want to constrain and how do you do it. And in fact, we had a triumph about 2 years ago. We got a paper published in the most prestigious American economics journal called the Journal of Economic Perspectives, which mostly publishes garbage, but it's the most prestigious economics journal. And it was, the lead author was Ken Arrow, who everybody agrees is the smartest and most distinguished economist in the world. And we had reported to us that one of the editors had said, we've just got to publish this paper by Ken Arrow and his communist colleagues. So there are economists who know what they're doing and are getting out there and looking at these issues, but the average politician doesn't even know there's an issue of how much consumption there is.
Paul Ehrlich and the Art of Scientific Stand-Up. He was at the Perth Convention Centre as the star of the Ecological Society of Australia conference. Paul Ehrlich is Professor of Biology at Stanford University in California and a member of the American Academy of Science. His books on our environmental future are written with his wife, Anne Ehrlich. On ABC Radio National, I'm Robin Williams.
And on the technology side, the last of the iPad equation, but not just technology, but how you service the consumption through technologies and through social arrangements. Like in Western Australia, do you keep on that positive feedback system of building more freeways so you can get more cars? That sort of thing. I gather you're moving away from that tradition out here now, but most of the world still has it. All you can say is, if you look back over the history of technological fixes to these problems, some are useful, none have been really determinative. And the worst thing is that most people in the United States think if everybody bought a Prius, the environmental problem would be over. Nobody even does the life history analysis of how much, as opposed to driving your old gas guzzler for another 5 years, how much energy is used to create the Prius, including moving the parts around the world and so on, and to get rid of it, and the batteries and so on and so forth. I don't know what the answer is. I don't think anybody's done it. But you got to do that sort of thing. But a good rule of thumb is, if we recycle absolutely everything, it will probably keep the society going for at least a week longer than if we don't. Recycling is great because it makes people feel good, but that ain't where the problem is. So, all right, I've outlined a not entirely cheery picture of the environmental situation. I think there's one big conclusion to draw from this, and it's science, natural scientists, environmental scientists in particular, know more than enough about what's wrong with the world to know what directions we ought to be moving in. One can say that for a lot of areas of the scholarly community, not just science, but society doesn't pay any attention to it. It brings us to my interest in cultural evolution. Cultural evolution is simply evolution in our non-genetic information, which for practical purposes is only evolution that counts in behavior now. If you like reading the evolutionary psychology literature, that's fine. Comic books are good too. They don't know anything much about psychology, and they sure as hell don't know anything about evolution. If they think, for example, that women can be selected in a generation to like men that drive fast cars. Those of you who've done selection experiments or know anything about what we're learning about the genome now, now that stuff is gibbering nonsense. But basically, what we know about cultural evolution is even less. We don't know how and why societies change and how to change them. And this means that the ball has really bounced largely into the court of the social scientists. And unfortunately, that court is rotted. They're terribly organized. They don't know what the problems are in large degree. And that's one place where you could give them a lot of help. In other words, social scientists generally have inferiority complexes because nobody pays attention to them. One of the reasons nobody pays attention to them is they do little fragmented studies on things that never get into the newspapers anyway, and so nobody much cares. But if social scientists took the position that if society is going to be saved, we have to get together and understand human behavior a lot better, and more than that, understand how, under certain ethical constraints, we can change human behavior, and we're trying it all the time. You know, universities are devices for changing human behavior, just like penitentiaries are and bars. And so we're doing it all the time, but there's no coherent theory. There's no thinking about how human beings interact with each other and with their environments in ways that are slowly driving us down the drain. Many of you may have seen the recent UNEP report, which kind of repeated what the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment says down deep. Everything is going in the wrong direction, and we don't know where the cliff is at the moment. And that's where we've got to recruit the social sciences into helping us. And it can be done. Some of them are very interested. We've actually got to slowly but surely trying to organize a Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior to go along with the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment to figure out how in hell, you know, 47% of Australians, in a sense, voted for John Howard to stay in office for another term. That's insane. Can there be that many ignorant people in Australia? There must be. In the United States, you know, over half the people in the country last time voted for George W. Bush, for the Bush crime family. Look, we're in the middle of a huge resource war right now, something that most behavioral scientists haven't even looked at. You know, there have been two big resource wars since the Second World War, the 1967 war over water between Israel and the Arabs, and now our attempt to grab and get control of the Middle Eastern oil, particularly Iraq's supplies. Even the head of the U.S. Central Bank admitted about 6 months ago, the war is over oil. Gretchen Daly, my colleague, said before we went into Iraq, I didn't know a single person Not a single individual who thought it was a smart idea. And yet the country went ahead and did it. Gretchen said, do you really suppose we'd be planning to invade Iraq if their principal export were broccoli? Got into Time magazine. But now the New York Times, for instance, that helped drive us into the war, is kind of recanting. How do you get an entire nation to go try and steal somebody else? Well, actually, it may not be somebody else's oil. As I think it was George Bush said, how did our oil get under their sand? Before they went in, Bush did not know the difference between a Sunni and a Shia. I doubt if he does today. So these are gigantic behavioral problems of knowledge, problems of education. You're the people, you're a superb group of scientists who know what needs to be done, which brings me to my final topic for the last hour and a half of the talk, which is, what should Australian ecologists be doing about all this? You're one of the, you do not want to underrate your power. If you get together, there are things called issue publics that sociologists look at. If you became an issue public, if hundreds of Australian scientists rose up and had said last year, the world's going to be destroyed if we vote for Howard and his like anymore. This is not, we're not playing around. That the environment is not another constituency. It's not another political issue. It's our lives, our children's lives, our grandchildren's lives. You cannot afford a John Howard. Put him back. What was he before? A crooked used car salesman? So, I don't know. Most of our politicians were crooked lawyers, but it varies from country to country. Get rid of them. Get out there and picket them. Get the scientific community together against them. At least we tried in the United States. The Ecological Society of America now has the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program, which trains ecologists to talk to the general public, to talk to congressional committees and so on. You say, wow, that's not part of science. That's bullshit. You just persuaded that by the Howards of the world. Of course it's part of science. You get out there, for example, and does anybody complain when the medical community says smoking's likely to give you cancer? Only to cigarette manufacturers. Everybody else think it's perfectly reasonable for doctors to recommend that you don't smoke, that you get a flu shot, and on and on and on. They're not considered to be out of their realm. Sure, you don't say, I can prove scientifically that if we do X, Y, and Z, this will happen to the climate. But you can say, scientists say these are the likely consequences. And as a scientist and somebody who's looked at it closely, I recommend to you, Senator, this, that, or the other thing. And if you do this as an entire society, you can have impact if you can get the media to cooperate. I don't know how many of you know the 1993 statements of the Union of Concerned Scientists and the world's scientific academies. Well, a few of you do. In 1993, the Union of Concerned Scientists got 1,500 of the most distinguished scientists in the world, including more than half of the Nobel laureates in science. And they got out a long statement which basically said, if we don't solve the population environment problem, we're screwed. And 58 academies of science, the Australian Academy, the Royal Society, the National Academy, and so on, got out a statement saying the same thing. The UCS actually hired a PR firm to push the statement. It never got anywhere in the press or the electronic media in the United States. Most people never heard of it. The world scientific community said, we are on a doomsday course. Literally, a collision course was the term in one of the statements. And nobody paid any attention. Getting the word out there is not easy. And one of your big jobs, in my view, is continue your ecological research. I could give you complaints about how ecological research is done today, but I won't bother, although I recommend Bill Lawrence's paper in the recent Australasian Ecology, I think it was called, about what Australian ecologists could be doing to broaden their impacts at our level. Spend 80% of your time doing the research you love. You wouldn't be in this business if you didn't love it. I would certainly not give up my time in the field looking for the painted honey eater just to save the world. I mean, the painted honey eater is one gorgeous bird. But take the other 20% or so and try and figure out how to improve your interaction with that other part of the complex adaptive system, namely the human system, that we understand now much less well than we understand the natural systems of the planet. And to end on a somewhat cheery note, as I do, I use the same ending in virtually every talk, so some of you have heard it before. One of the things that cheers me when looking at cultural evolution, and we are actually doing some work on, among other things, using Polynesia as a test system, one of the things that's cheering is that societies change for reasons we don't fully understand, sometimes incredibly rapidly. There are lots of examples like desegregation in the United States, where the whole racial situation changed in about 10 years, or the role of women in the United States. Same thing, both triggered by World War II, we know in retrospect. But I don't understand the big transformation that I saw in Australia when I first came out here. I spent a year with Charles Birch in 65, 66. This will show you a gigantic and important transformation. When I left, people asked me to please send them something in a plain brown envelope after I got back to the States, because an issue of Playboy was banned in Australia because it showed Jane Mansfield semi-nude sitting on the edge of a bed with a fully dressed man, sitting on a bed with a fully dressed man sitting on the edge of the bed. This led to banning. Came back in 1971, I think, 70 or 71, settled down in our apartment, turned on the TV, and a fully nude frontal female crossed the screen. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I also found that restaurants had appeared in Australia. Some of you younger people may not believe this, but there were no restaurants at all in Australia in 65, 66. Now Sydney is the best town in the world to eat in. All of that changed in about 10 or so years, less than that in Australia. And the explanation that it was immigrants, I don't believe. There's something beyond that. The most famous example recently, of course, is that not a single one of the politically sophisticated people that I know predicted that the Soviet Union and communism would collapse in the way that it did, but it did. So which tells you that when the time is ripe, society can change dramatically rapidly. And I think that's also true for the environmental situation. When the time is ripe, we could change very rapidly. And I think your job is to help everybody else ripen the time. Thank you.
That was Paul Ehrlich at the Convention Centre in Perth. He was the star of the Ecological Society of Australia conference, and now he's back at Stanford University in California. His latest book, Once for Nineveh, asks why what was once the fertile crescent of the Middle East is now desert, and what we should learn from the lessons of history.
Our last speaker is William Engdahl, an economist whose articles on the financial tsunami I read on the show several weeks ago. He's also the author of a book, Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. At the beginning of the interview, he takes on the population control question in a way that draws the same contradictions that have been highlighted this week. While religious forces have opposed halting population growth and opposed contraception, the population control camp has often been associated with people advocating eugenics and other master race ideologies, seeking a human monoculture, just as the GMO corporations are seeking to create the same through seed patenting. On the flip side, joining environmentalists and left activists in the fight against the patenting of life and genetically modified seeds are many of the religious right, leaving the science establishment aligned with the corporations on the other side. Engdahl was interviewed by Helen Lobato of 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
The hidden agenda, the reason I wrote this book, this is book number two in what will be a trilogy, hopefully by the end of this year, is the people who finance the research to the tune of hundreds of millions of research dollars over the past decades are the same people who financed the entire field of eugenics research in the 1920s, the 1930s, on into the post-war world. These are people with names such as the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, whose agenda is control of population growth worldwide. It's a horrific agenda. And their concept is, if we can patent seeds and get control through the main seed distribution companies worldwide, and also patent the select pesticides and herbicides that go to those seeds, then we have the potential for the first time in human history to actually control the world food supply. And that is the hidden agenda of genetic manipulation. It's based on absolutely fraudulent science. It is not science. It's like throwing mud on a wall and hoping that some of it sticks. It's highly unstable. That's the biological side of it. But for the people who stand behind companies such as Monsanto or Syngenta in Switzerland, which is really a British company in the end, or DuPont and Dow Chemical, these are the same people who brought us Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, whose damages are still being adjudicated in American courts almost 35 years after. These are the people who brought us dioxin poisoning across the United States in chemical factories downriver. And they're the same companies who are behind the development of patenting of seeds in order that they can control it.
Now, where did this control of populations and food begin?
Well, where did it begin is kind of a difficult question to pinpoint precisely, but I think if you go back to the 1970s, early 1970s, the Nixon administration, on the advice of John D. Rockefeller III at that point, who was a fanatic about birth control, population control, intrauterine devices. He had literally jubilation over every breakthrough that could potentially sterilize or prevent birth in women back then. He convinced Nixon to do a study of world population growth and American national security interests. Kissinger was appointed to head the study. It was called NSSM 200, National Strategy Security Memorandum, and it was a top-secret study. It was done with the complicity of the Pentagon, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, State Department, and so on. And NSSM basically said, if you look around the world, there are countries who have a robust population expansion who also happen to have very, very abundant supplies of oil, precious minerals, precious metals, or metals rather, and strategic minerals that America needs for its national defense. So on the ground of national security, through which anything on the face of this earth has been justified by the security state during the Cold War, they said population control is an American national security priority. No aid will be given to any developing or third world country unless they have an effective birth control contraceptive program for the masses of their population in place. And that literally, with vociferous objection from organizations connected largely with the Catholic Church, that became American foreign policy. It was kept secret until 1990 or 91, I believe, when through a Freedom of Information inquiry by a Catholic lay organization in the United States, the NSSM document was released to the public. I've read the document in full many, many times, and it is a blueprint for genocide.
So what does this desire to depopulate have to do with GMOs?
Well, very much. If you control the food supply, if you have patented seeds and they have to come in India or Australia, come to Monsanto every year to get new seeds, and you have Terminator in your seeds, which the plants commit suicide after one harvest, you must constantly come back. You don't have any seed corn that you can save over to the next harvest, which has been practiced in world agriculture for thousands of years. That's over. You are utterly dependent as a vassal on the goodwill of these three or four multinational agribusiness corporations, three of which have ties to the Pentagon. So you don't need to be that clever to figure out that is huge power in the hands of three or four private companies over life and death on the planet.
Mm. The book explores the world of food production from the Green Revolution to the Genetic Revolution, and we see that behind the scenes are the same powerful elite for controlling all the moves.
Yes. Well, Argentina, Carlos Menem, who was a close family friend of the Bush family, became the president of Argentina during the late 80s or early 90s during the debt crisis down there. And he appointed a commission. The parliament in Argentina, the Congress, had no say whatsoever of this. There was no public debate. And the commission was stacked by representatives of Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, I think BASF of Germany was among them. And out of that, Menem made a decision to award exclusive licensing to Monsanto to proliferate its genetically modified soybean in Argentina. Today, 97% of all soybeans out of Argentina are genetically manipulated. Now, what does that mean for world agriculture? All the beef we eat in the world, a common cattle feed used in that beef, largely is a mixture that contains soybeans. There are three major producers of soybeans on the planet: Argentina, the United States, and Brazil. Up until a year and a half ago, the Brazilian government forbade genetically modified seeds. Well, under huge pressure and infiltration through Argentina by Monsanto and others, the Brazilian government was finally threw in the towel and changed its law to allow genetically modified seeds in its soybean production. So now you don't even have the guarantee that Brazilian seeds can be free of genetic manipulation. That means that all the cattle, all the beef that is on the table that we're eating worldwide likely is not is somehow contaminated with GMO. The effects of GMO in the stomach of a cow are completely unmonitored. Most of the effects of this are only visible over long-term studies, such as 10 or even 12, 15 years. And those long-term studies have not been conducted by any government on the face of this earth for whatever reasons, largely political reasons. And that is a scary thing about GMO. Why has the Washington government, where the GMO experiment was first unleashed on a mass scale back in the 90s, why has the Washington, every single president since George Herbert Walker Bush in 1992, has said we need no special controls over GMO? It's just like corn, it's just like soybeans, it's just like cotton, it's just like wheat. It looks the same, it tastes the same. So don't worry, just treat it the same as corn. Mm. And that fact alone is, I think some people ought to be sitting behind prison bars for allowing that to happen.
And that sort of shows the agenda, the hidden agenda.
Yes, yes.
Now, fast forward to 2003, and George Bush was talking about the seeds of democracy that he was sowing in Iraq. But you write that the democracy was not the only seeds that the U.S. wished to plant.
Well, I don't think they even wish to plant the seeds of democracy, but that's a whole other discussion. In 2003, Paul Bremer, who was the, if you want to call him the Roman consul, appointed over the Iraqi nation, Paul Bremer III, who used to be the head of Kissinger Associates, so he's close friends with Henry Kissinger, came in there and he imposed on the Iraqi nation and the Iraqi people a set of 100, and they called them orders, you know, like the military, here's your orders, you do this or do you die. And those 100 orders, Order 81, included a violation of the Iraqi National Constitution and made it Iraqi law that patented seeds have to be permitted. The Iraqi Constitution forbade patenting of life. They said there you cannot have a patent on life, life forms. Well, that's now thrown out the window. It turned out on the research that I did for the book, I found out, lo and behold, that the people who wrote Order 81 in Iraq were none other than the Washington lobbyists of Monsanto Corporation, the world's largest genetically modified seed purveyor. So they're trying to turn Iraq into a source for genetically modified, I think genetically modified wheat. And the significance of that is huge, because Iraq, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, is the so-called cradle of civilization, but Iraq is the center of most of the wheat varieties known on the face of the earth today. And if they can get these under GMO control, then they've got the whole wheat varieties on the planet under GMO control. So this is strategically important, not just the oil in Iraq.
Yep. And could you tell us about what happened to Iraq's own stored seeds?
Well, they had a seed vault, ironically, in a place that's now infamous worldwide with American torture methods, Abu Ghraib, in the same city where the prison is. That seed vault, that treasure storehouse of all these seed varieties that have developed over thousands of years in Iraq by cross-pollination and so forth, that disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to it. Gone.
Terrible. And then they couldn't even get access to their secondary store that was in, Syria.
Yeah. Yeah, that's controlled by the Rockefeller Foundation, ultimately. CGIAR. Why, if it's such a boon to mankind, why does GMO only spread through bribery, corruption, violence, and such things? If it's so good, why do they have to resort to such mafia gangster style tactics to spread their stuff?
And another example of how this works can be seen in the avian flu debacle. Can you remind us again of this media-driven so-called pandemic and what actually has happened to the Asian chicken farmers?
Well, ironically, the H5N1 panic, the origins of the contaminated birds, various ornithological organizations began getting suspicious when reports came out of the World Health Organization and especially out of the U.S. government that these birds were migrating from China, Vietnam, places like this. They were migrating westward. Now, you don't have to be a great student of bird migration habits to know that bird migrations always go from north to south according to the seasons. They follow the solar radiation fields, and never do birds migrate from east to west. And you imagine a bird on its deathbed with H5N1 virus taking off from Vietnam and landing somewhere in Ukraine or even up in the islands in North Germany. This is just a fairy tale. And what they found was that the transmission path of these diseased birds in every case could be tied to a major factory farm mass production of chickens. CG Group of Thailand is one of the biggest in the world. Tyson Foods is all over Asia. And these mass-produced chickens are pumped up with all sorts of unhealthy antibiotics. They are grown in conditions where they never see sunlight for a second of their short lives. And the health conditions in these Vietnamese and Thai factory farms, chicken farms, are atrocious beyond belief. These are breeding grounds for bacteria, diseases, and so forth. And in every case, if you follow the transportation routes of these chickens, the truck routes, because they're shipped all over the world, that's the scary thing about this agribusiness globalization of food. If you have contamination, you're going to spread this all over the world. It's not just going to the local village.
Yeah.
And that, in every case that's been documented, the organization GRAIN in Canada did an excellent report on this about 2 years ago. You can tie it to a factory farm industrial chicken production. They say, the agribusiness says, well, the real danger is these free-walking chickens that graze on the natural grasses and are in the fresh air. It's just the opposite. Those are the healthy chickens, and those are the ones that have to be put in cages, as they said. They're going to bankrupt all the small family chicken farms of Asia, and the only thing that will be left is their agribusiness. And now they're working on creating a genetically modified chicken that can replace the entire chicken population. Cambridge University in England estimates in 5 years if they get it get the details worked out.
It is the most sinister story. And at this time in Australia, the state of Victoria, where we are listening to you, is set to lift its ban on the growing of GM canola.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say?
I hope your population, your consumers in Victoria and your farmers are active enough to do something to reverse that horrible decision.
Mm. We're trying.
Yeah.
It's interesting, and I wonder how it really works. Are there areas of the world that are designated by the powers, such as the World Trade Organizations, to be the growers of this stuff? Because I find it hard to fathom out why anyone would want to grow GM crops when people simply don't want to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work?
Well, they spread it first to American farmers who were going through a real economic hard times back in the early 90s. And they said, with this, you can improve your crop yields, you use less fertilizer, your costs go down, and so forth. Well, the farmers bought onto it big time, and then they were locked into a death trap with GMO. Then they spread it to Argentina through this control of the debt and the corruption of President Menem that I talked about earlier. Then they're trying to spread it in Africa, and these African countries say, we don't want your U.S. food aid in the form of genetically modified seeds. We want to have money so we can buy food from our neighbors here in Africa, where it's food that we know and that we prefer to eat. So one after the other, they're trying to do this. They're trying to break down the doors of resistance here in Europe. I'm sitting here in Germany. And they're having one heck of a hard time doing it. And Germany still has a law that the liability rests with the farmer who plants GMO, not like what Percy Schmeiser was the victim of in Canada, where the liability is just the opposite. If the wind carries the seed onto your farm, you're liable to pay license fees to Monsanto for Monsanto's pollution of your soil. But it's just a fight on every front here. If people are interested in further following this in depth, they can go on to the website of Global Research in Canada. That's www.globalresearch.ca, and there they can order the book Seeds of Destruction, Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, and I would hope that that book could get out widely in Australia, New Zealand, and such places in the English-speaking world, so that people know this is not simply an alarm about a potential health issue. This is one of the most dangerous developments in the history of mankind, comparable to the development of the nuclear bomb.
William Engdahl, author of Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, interviewed by Helen Lobato of 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. I hope you appreciated the material and that it's got you going. You can always download an MP3 or podcast of this and all previous episodes at the archives at unwelcomeguests.org. Please be patient, as the server has been overwhelmed lately. If you're one of the thousands of people who listen to this as a podcast, please consider making a donation to the AINFOS Radio Project that hosts the site for this and lots of wonderful community radio audio. AINFOS needs a server upgrade badly. Just click on the donate button on the homepage of radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4ALL.net. And if you're hearing this on the radio, please support your station, because there are very few stations that would ever air a show like this. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. That won't be my end, for my guns and myself will all